by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make heaven in the middle of it. Grass make heaven in the middle. We come. Grass make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We have one of the finest guests that we've ever been able to schedule in this evening. And his name is Ronald J. Olive. He's the author of Capturing Jonathan Pollard, How One of the Most Notorious Spies in American History Was Brought to Justice. Welcome to our program, Ron Olive.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
I know in your book, tell our listening audience first a little bit of your background and how you got into intelligence work there for the Navy.
Well, I joined the what was called back then the Naval Investigative Service, and it was in Suitland, Maryland. Before that, I was a police officer.
Okay.
And then I went into federal law enforcement, and that's where I wound up in Suitland, Maryland, as a federal agent, and worked for 22 years as a federal agent with. It was NIS, Naval Investigative Service, at the time. Now most of your listeners know that it's the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, which is a program run by Mark Harmon.
Okay. And this Jonathan Pollard, there's just been a recent announcement. He's being released on parole after 30 years of serving a life sentence, and there's a lot of controversy, is there not, about, there's two sides here. There's the government side, the federal side, and then there's the public side that's allied with Israel about this is too harsh a sentence and all that. Now, in your book, you really go through a lot of different chapters here to try to establish a more objective view. Is that what your goal was?
Yes, it was. I needed to establish an objective point of view and a very factual point of view. It took me just about 4 years to write this book because I had to make sure that everything I put in this book could be verified by anyone who ever reads it. There was no making stuff up. There was no what ifs. It was factual information that I researched. Not only did I live through this case, which allowed me to do great research on it at the time, and interview numerous people who were involved with the Naval Investigative Service and other organizations.
Right. So Jonathan Pollard had been an intelligence analyst himself, working for the U.S. Naval Investigative Services Anti-Terrorist Alert Center when he started, dealing a lot of espionage work for foreign countries, primarily Israel. Is that right?
Yes. He started working for the Naval Investigative Service at that time. He became in the Anti-Terrorist Alert Center. He was assigned to the Anti-Terrorist Alert Center. I was at headquarters at that time. And to start this story off, I didn't know Jonathan Pollard. I was stationed overseas, and then I came back to headquarters, which was in Suitland, Maryland at the time. One day, he walks through the door. Now, this is all top secret, sensitive compartment information areas, and I never knew who he was, so I was getting promoted to a GS-13 and going to the Washington field office when he walks through the door at our headquarters in Suitland and introduces himself to me and says, hey, I understand that you're going to the field office. Congratulations. And then he started talking about, you know, hey, maybe I can help you with some things like arms sales through South Africa. And I'm listening to this guy and saying to myself, who is this guy and where is he coming from? Make a long story short, nothing ever came of it. And I forgot about him because then I was transferred to be the assistant special agent in charge of the Washington field office. And about, a month and a half later, a co-worker saw Jonathan Pollard at our headquarters building. I was in the field office now. And Jonathan Pollard started waving this package around, which was wrapped up like top secret material. And there's another category above that, which is critical sensitive information in this package. Everyone knew it because it was packaged the way it's supposed to be. So the coworker didn't think anything about it. And Pollard says, well, I need to go downstairs, and now I have to destroy this because I've got the wrong information. Nobody thought anything about it. Coworker leaves the building. Right after he leaves the building, he goes across the street, sits in his car waiting for his wife, and Pollard's wife drives up. This is on a Friday evening around 5 o'clock. Pollard comes down the steps with this top-secret, sensitive, compartmented information package, gets in her car, and drives off. But now you have a coworker who went through all kinds of thoughts through his mind. Why does Pollard have this package? I know it's sensitive, compartmented information. He shouldn't have it. Maybe his boss told him to take it to another location. He was so upset he didn't know what to do. And finally, he called his boss and told him what happened. And the next thing I know, we start an investigation on Jonathan Pollard for unauthorized classified information. And this was probably the fastest worked espionage case that I'm aware of in the history of the United States. From the time the coworker saw him walk out with that package to the time we arrested him was only 2 weeks. Most espionage investigations last for years until they try to get it right. This lasted for 2 weeks, and Pollard was under arrest.
Boy, you say in here in your preface that he actually transferred or sold to Israel more than 1 million pages of classified material.
That is absolutely correct.
Now his supporters are denying that that there was that much intelligence ever supplied provided to Israel. They're saying that he carried it out 4 or 5 times in a briefcase. There's all kinds of information here, is there not?
Yeah, there is, but I can tell you this. They're wrong, and
yes,
the guy that did the damage assessment, I know personally. He did the damage assessment. Now, this is his Department of Defense civilian, okay? He did the damage assessment on almost every spy there is, Ron Pelton, all the Navy spies that were at that period of time. You know, the 1980s was the decade of the spy, and 1985 was the year of the spy, literally. But Jonathan Pollard walked out of that headquarters building 2 or 3 times a day with a suitcase, went out to his car, drove off, put the suitcase of top-secret SCI material into transferred it from his briefcase into the trunk. He did that 2 or 3 times a day, 3 or 4 times a week. And he would save it up, and then he would bring it to a safe house where the Israelis had a secretary working that would copy the information that he stole and had to return. I'm talking top secret, sensitive stuff. And
right.
the stuff that he didn't have to return because it was secret or it wasn't stamped, they kept. So when you hear right. that Jonathan Pollard stole over 1 million hard copy paper of highly classified intelligence information, that is the truth. It would fit.
Well, and you say in here, go ahead.
I'll tell you how much it was.
Okay.
When it was worked out by the individual that I knew very well, because he did the damage assessment, as I told you earlier, it wound up that if it was stacked, it would be stacked 6 foot high, 6 foot wide, and 10 feet long. That's well over 1 million pages of hard copy paper. There was no disc at those times. There was no, little chips that one carried out. It was all hard copy paper, just like you put in your paper machine.
Sure.
And
sure.
he did that for 18 months. So was it a million? It was well over a million.
It says in here in your preface, as a result of his theft of these classified documents, his espionage activity did irreparable damage to the national defense of the United States.
Yes.
There was one report that he provided, I guess Israel or whoever he was feeding this information to, the radio signal notations manual. Is
yes,
that true?
That is true. Which
Now, that shows right there that he was way outside of just trying to help Israel, or the United States to meet an agreement. Now, he alleged that there was an agreement to provide intelligence to Israel, that the United States was not meeting that agreement. Is there any
substance
to that?
That's
not true.
That is not true. What?
Oh, okay.
What he did was made these deliveries to Israel undercover when he would take these documents to the secretary that was close to the Israeli embassy. And he knew what he was doing. And the story is he was doing it for probably the love of Israel. You know, they weren't providing the United States with the information that they needed. That is all just not true.
Just that radio signal notations manual would tell you that he went way far beyond just trying to help Israel a little bit. See what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Because that's very dangerous and very sensitive information.
Let me set the record straight.
Yeah.
He gave this information to Israel. He gave this information to Israel because of greed and money. It had nothing to do with providing Israel with information that the United States was refusing to give to them. His entire objective was greed and money. And for 18 years, it was for greed and money constantly. They would pay him $10,000 at a time. It got up to 20. He was getting $1,500 from his handler, from his Israeli handler that would fly in and give him the money every month, And he was demanding more. He says, "This isn't enough. I want $2,500 every month." So they agreed to it. Israel agreed to it. It was his greed for money. It had nothing to do with Israel, and poor Israel wasn't getting information. It was all that.
Yeah, you say in here that he was a master of deceit and manipulation who repeatedly beat the system in manipulating, I guess, not only within his intelligence analyst job, but the Israelis trying to get more and more money, right?
Yeah, that was the whole reason. And they gave him trips overseas, him and his wife, and living the good life. Oh, yeah, he was in his own world. him and his wife, who was involved with him also very much, and her name was Ann Pollard.
Yeah, now she admitted then to being a partner in his espionage activities.
That's correct.
Right? Now there was a long drawn out negotiation. This never went to trial. Is that correct?
It never went to trial, and both of them pleaded guilty. Jonathan Pollard,
right,
and Ann Pollard both pleaded guilty. Ann Pollard got 2 5-year sentences to run concurrently, and Jonathan Pollard received life in prison to be eligible for parole in 30 years. And that's what happened.
Right. And now, was there any truth to Bill Clinton when the Y plantation negotiations were underway?
Yeah.
Is there any truth that there was negotiations at that time to release Jonathan Pollard, but Bill Clinton reneged on those agreements? Was there any truth to that?
Well, that's a funny story. And yeah, President Clinton did renege, but what was happening at the Y plantation was Benjamin Netanyahu was there, and they were trying to make a deal for Jonathan Pollard. And Arafat was there too. And what happened was Bill Clinton said, well, okay, I'll go for that deal. If you do this, we'll give you Pollard, you know, if you go along with this agreement between us and Arafat, that, you know, we'll return Pollard. Well, the word in the intelligence community, as soon as he spoke those words, went out like a flash message. And so George Tenet, who was the director of the CIA at the time, when he got word of what President Clinton just offered, he immediately went out there and told, and this is his exact words, what he told the President of the United States. He said, this is almost in quotes, if you release Jonathan Pollard to the Israelis, I will give you my resignation as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency immediately. So Clint is like, whoa. So he knew that George Tenet was dead serious, and Tenet also told him, he says, you don't understand. The entire intelligence community of the United States needs to be in on what you are trying to do. This is not a one-party thing that even the president can do. It has to be, you know, looked at and worked out. And so Clinton knew he was in trouble. So he told Arafat, forget about it. I can't do this to you.
Right. Was intelligence that was added by and secured by Pollard, did it result in some of our agents being taken out?
Not that I'm aware of. You know,
okay.
Audrey James is a different story. But
okay.
As far as
now there's things here that I don't want to get into, of course, and you're probably aware that I'm not here to out any current classified information. You know what I mean?
Oh no.
And I want to be careful. So you know you call me on the carpet there if I get into areas that we shouldn't get into. Okay.
No, let me tell you something. But, there's no area
yeah.
that we can't get into, and if there is, I would tell you so. But
okay, well that's what I need. I need to know because I had a small intelligence, experience there with the Army Security Agency
yeah.
for 3 years, and you didn't, I wasn't 3 years in there, but I certainly respected the work that intelligence people do.
No, my book was gone through with a fine tooth comb. And there was not even one solitary word, a word, even the, or anything, was not taken out of my book. Not one word. It was published. It was authorized by the Department of the Navy that this that my book could be published and made published for the American people. They didn't take one word, one sentence out of my book.
Well, that's a tribute to you, Ron, on your research and staying within the good reporting and on a book on this.
Well, you know, it took
wasn't
me four
easy
years
to put together,
to
was
this
it?
Book.
Huh?
Because I was not going to have anyone come back on me and say, oh, well, wasn't
right.
correct. This wasn't right. This
right.
happened. You know, it's been 30 years now. No one has ever come to me and said, what you said in your book at this point isn't true. Not one.
Well, that's a tribute to your work in this area, see. Also, it seems that the information I read, you know, through your book and so forth, it seemed to indicate that he was a wheeler dealer, Pollard was. He was going to work some kind of arms deal and stuff like that. Is there substance to that?
Oh, yeah. No, he wanted to work with all kinds of countries, you know. That is absolutely correct, because he wanted more money and more money, you know. And some of the countries that he approached. Now, this is while he's working for Israel, and Israel
okay.
doesn't have a clue about what else he's doing. So there was 11 other countries that Pollard approached on working for him, and you know, Australia. There was Pakistan. He talked to the French, the Brazilians, China. He even thought about going to Saudi Arabia. I mean, going to the embassy for Saudi Arabia, because there was a lot of people being arrested during that time in the mid 1980s, and he got a little afraid. So he thought, well, you know, maybe I'm going to go to the embassy of Saudi Arabia in D.C. What he told us was because the Saudis are a cleaner target, like in quotes. It was a cleaner target. But even Ann Pollard, his wife, gave classified information to China, you know. He gave it to Argentina guy, an officer from Argentina. He showed him top secret sensitive compartment and information when this guy didn't have, he was visiting at Suitland, Maryland. As they do, they bring in officers from other countries, you know, just to show them some of the stuff without providing them with any top secret material. And Pollard was providing, just flapping it out, top secret material, sensitive compartment and information. And the officer was so worried, he called back to his boss and said, listen, this guy is telling me stuff that I shouldn't be knowing this kind of stuff. So what happened was his boss thought, you know what, they might be trying to do a sting operation against you. You need to get out of there now. So he did. And none of that came out until after Pollard was under arrest. They thought that either the United States was trying to trick them into something, or this was a no good deal, that whatever they were trying to do, they didn't want any part of it.
My gosh. But you talk about a wheeler dealer in my gosh. Now there was a colonel that approached him at the beginning, Saya.
Yeah.
Colonel Saya.
Abraham Sella.
Y'all negotiated, our government, with not indicting him or something, or gave him some kind of a deal, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then Pollard's wife, how many years did she serve in prison?
Let me go back.
Oh, okay.
Let me go back to Sella.
Okay, tell her. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when the word came out, what happened was Pollard had some highly classified information in his house, and we took it. And I told him to come in the next day. Well, that, within a 3 or 4 day period, unbeknownst to us, they were in contact with Avium Sella. And Sella didn't know what was going on. So his wife, while we were, while myself and some others were interviewing Pollard that night, Ann Pollard, who was, they were supposed to meet Sella for dinner, went to where they were supposed to meet for dinner, and he said, "Jay's in trouble. You know, this is what's going on." Well, Sella jumped up from the table that he was at, and he said, "Listen, Ann, I can't talk to you anymore. Do you want to go with me to Israel?" You know, and she says, "No, I'm staying with Jonathan." And he said, "Okay." He ran out the door and made some phone calls. And the next thing we know, the next day, everyone involved in this operation by Israel was gone. They all found a way to get out. And they all made
but
it out.
They were gone. Man.
It's crazy. It was crazy. This whole story is crazy, actually.
Yeah. You know, they're supposed to be our allies, but they were using Pollard to get what they wanted, right?
Exactly. Exactly. They didn't ask Pollard if he wanted to spy. Let me tell you what happened.
Okay.
Pollard had a friend in New York, and he said, "Hey, this friend, Avian Sella, he's a colonel in the Israeli Air Force, and he's a top-notch fighter pilot. Jay, they call him Jay, you know, Jonathan Jay Pollard. Would you like to meet this guy?" And boy, Pollard went, "Oh, yes, yes, yes. I really want to meet this guy." So it was made that they would meet at the Hilton Hotel on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. for lunch. So you have this Israeli fighter pilot meeting Pollard for lunch. And this fighter pilot, he doesn't know who Pollard is in reality. He knew a little bit about him. But so they made this appointment for lunch. So when they sit down at a table at the Hilton Hotel in Connecticut there, Pollard said, "You know, I know your history." He said, "I know you're a fighter pilot." And then out of the clear blue sky, he said, "Here's what I want to do for Israel. I want to work for Israel. I want to spy for you guys." And he told them he had access to top secret sensitive compartment and information from every intelligence agency in Washington, D.C. And so this Avian Sella, not expecting anything like this, and in my book I say I can imagine what he was doing. He was looking around the room where they were eating lunch, thinking, you know, is this a setup? This can't be that
right.
Easy. Nobody can just come in and say, "I want to spy for you, and this is what I can do. Am I being set up here?" So,
right.
But he decided that he wasn't, that Pollard was real, and he wanted. So Sella then gives him code numbers for a telephone number. He said, "I'll call you on one of these code numbers. When I do, when that phone rings and you see what the number was, you hang up and you go to the," he gave him about four or five different locations to meet at. Just say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or whatever. But he used the Israeli alphabet and the place that Pollard should be after he calls. And he would,
right.
Then Pollard would receive another call where on an outdoor payphone, and he'd wait for the ring, and Stella would give him information on what he needed to do.
Right. Well, I tell you, it really got excessive there, didn't it? And like you were saying earlier, he went for the money, didn't he?
It was greed, period. Greed.
Right.
And you know, I'm unfortunately, you know, a lot of people, as you said earlier, just don't understand the quantity and quality of the information that he passed. It was absolutely devastating. I mean, the United States had to redo their entire intelligence gathering program because of what he did, which cost, you know, probably, I don't know how much it cost, but it had to have been in the billions.
Right. You said here that insider betrayal is the most dangerous threat to our national security and national economy.
Yes, I truly believe that. I truly believe it.
So it's the man that is standing there in an enemy's uniform that's firing at you that's the most dangerous. It's the people that are inside of some of these organizations that are betraying, right?
Exactly. It's the insider threat that is the true danger. It's all about the insider threat. And it comes from many directions, you know. Anybody who civilians or whatever who joins the government or even in corporate America, I'm talking corporate America and government and other organizations. Most of the people, I would say 99% of the people, when they want to go to work for whatever, any kind of corporation or government agency, there are not many that plan, when I get in there, you know, I'm going to start stealing stuff from them because that's what I want to do. It's almost never that way. But there is something that happens with some people. You know, you see it today on TV, the gory stuff, you know, people shooting up theaters and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't like that back in those days. Just that, listen, I'm sick and tired of this. They're not paying me enough money. I'm going to take this in my own hands. And they start stealing proprietary information and stuff like that and sell it to other companies trying to, you know, get the better job or get paid money for it. That's the way it was. And that's the way it still is. It's not publicized like it used to be, but nobody's going to tell me that it's not happening because it is.
Right.
Again,
a man once said, "A nation can survive its fools and even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within." Cicero.
I'm sorry. Huh? I'm sorry. I lost you for a minute there.
Oh, okay. A nation can survive its fools and even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within. And he goes on to say some other things, but that was Cicero. Roman statesman. Well, they had it down, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. You're cutting out just a little bit.
That's 106 to 43 B.C., Roman statesman, philosopher, and orator, Cicero. Well, I tell you what, your book is really, it's really straightening up to me and giving me a much more objective view of this whole episode of Jonathan Pollard, because the press and this liberal, I don't know who's doing it. I guess Israel is behind some of the information out there, but they just continue to publicize scurrilous, against our government, you know, like we did wrong, and we're the people that are wrong in condemning him to 30 years or life sentence.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we're the ones that are wrong now. That's what they're saying, right?
Right. I mean,
I didn't steal any secrets, and
I know.
You didn't either, but he did. And he made money doing it.
He made, you know, for spying for 18 months, and this is usually the case when it comes to spies, with few exceptions. Some of them might make $1 million, but 99% of them make peanuts. Like Pollard, 18 months, although they did give him $10,000 raises and all that kind of stuff, they spent that money like water. In no time, it was gone, and they were asking for more and more and more. And I would say, I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but it was around $50,000, maybe $52,000 he made off of them in 18 months. And went to jail for life.
Oh my gosh!
After 30 years, he could be paroled. And you know, you stop and you ask yourself, you have to be kidding me. This guy and his wife did this for a little more than $50,000, and he goes to jail for 30 years. Let's calculate this. what's wrong with that picture.
Right.
You don't think. Fowler thinks he knew it all, though. You know, Fowler was a very intelligent individual, but he also lived in a fancy world. And he could talk your shirt off your back. He could talk for hours on any topic you want to talk about without stopping. That's what he did. And so people finally just blew him off as an eccentric. You know, oh, that literally, they would tell me when I did all my research, you know, yeah, you know, Pollard would brag about this and that, and nobody would listen to him anymore. They just blew him off and let him go on about whatever he wanted to talk about. They were fed up.
He had some kind of delusions, though, about who he was. Like, didn't he lie about being a Mossad agent at one time? And his dad was in the CIA. Is that, or are those some lies that he was caught in?
Those are absolute lies he was caught in.
right.
Yeah, he was telling the people.
So, I mean, he had this, what, overly impertinent of who he thought he was?
Yes, but almost from his childhood, he wanted to be a spy. They in college, he used to make up spy games with people, you know, and let's do the spy this, spy that. And one incident that occurred that we didn't find out about, of course, until much later, is when he was at, I think it was Stanford University. I don't know where he got this gun, but he started waving this gun around in the room where his roommates were, you know, in this college, and yelling that everybody is out to get him. He didn't shoot the gun, but he was waving it around. He was like crazy. So when he was interviewed after this whole thing was over, you know, years, decades later, he was asked, you know, what was this incident all about where you had this gun, you know, swinging it around in this college dorm? You know, what was that all about? He says, that's because I was a little off and I had some hallucinogenic mushrooms that I ate. And some hashish and stuff like that. It's just, you know, I went off. Oh.
My gosh. Was he heavily involved in drugs or not throughout this whole episode?
Later on, when they were making all this money, both him and Ann, their drug of choice was cocaine.
Okay.
And they would take cocaine from others that I interviewed who knew him, civilians, that we didn't find out about until later, that he would, sometimes when they would go out to dinner, he would literally roll up a bill and lay out coke and sniff it. Now.
Oh my gosh.
That's what an individual who knew Pollard very well told me. I couldn't verify that, but I can tell you this, when he was arrested, he admitted that he had been using cocaine for a long time, and they gave him treatment for it.
Right. Was there any kind of a psychological, I guess, evaluation done on Pollard?
Yes. There was a couple of them. Particularly in the beginning, you know, he tried to go to work for several agencies. He tried to go to work first for the CIA, all right?
Okay.
And the CIA gave him a polygraph. And during the polygraph, the CIA found out that, you know, he had already told 9 foreign nationals that he was going to work for the CIA. I mean, crazy stuff like that. And they said, so have you ever done drugs? And he says, yeah. He said, you know, I smoked a little marijuana, you know. And so the guy interviewing him, so Jonathan, give me an idea. How many times about did you use marijuana? And he said, about 600 times. So with that, and with him telling 9 foreign nationals that he was going to work for the CIA, they said, you need to go. And that's when he went to work for Naval Intelligence.
Was there something in, within the security clearance there that, that there was a failure that did not uncover his unstable, you know, the drug use and all that?
No. What was uncovered is with all of this stuff and his actions and his psychological problems he had, they gave him a doctor. The Navy gave him a doctor. You know, to evaluate him, and the Navy doctor said he's okay, but you need to watch him. And he went to a private psychologist that his father got for him, and he gave, of course, a clean bill of health. Pollard beat the system over and over and over again. In reality, as soon as Pollard was hired by the Naval Intelligence Command in Suitland, Portland, I mean in Suitland, Maryland. From that time on, he should have been fired right then. And the civilian who was working under this captain went to the captain several times saying, Pollard, he said, we have to get rid of Pollard. And this is before the year was set up, you know, where they could get rid of somebody. There was a year period where they were on probation, you know. But they kept giving him a break, giving him a break, giving him a break, and then they just forgot about him. The next thing you know, the year was up, and he was part of the, he was hired then. He couldn't.
I see.
During those days, you couldn't fire somebody unless they committed armed robbery or something, you know, right in front of you. It was ridiculous. And the civilian tried to tell this captain 3-4 times, you have to get rid of this guy because, you know, he is a problem employee. And he tells this captain, and he says, and the other thing is, he is a major security risk to this organization. And commanding officer gave a break after break after break.
Man. Before he was arrested, did he seek asylum at the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C.?
Yes. Him and Ann decided that they needed to get out. And this was a time when, you know, by the time November was over in 1984, there was like, Nine spies had already been arrested, 4 more to go, Ron Pelton, Larry Wu Tai-Chin, and then Pollard and Ann when they were arrested trying to go into the Israeli embassy.
My gosh. And then there's this story about Ann Pollard, shaking an FBI agent and then meeting Sella at a restaurant. We went into that a little bit earlier, right?
That's correct.
And yeah, that's when Sella and them took off, flew out of the country the next day, I guess. Huh?
Or that night. They left D.C. that night. They left D.C.
Oh, my gosh.
And some of them left through Tonopoli. Let's see. There's an airport outside of Washington, D.C. It starts with T. I can't recall the name of it. But that's where
Andrews?
A lot of them flew out of, which is small airport that a lot of times the Israelis would fly into and out instead of going through busy D.C., you know, at that airport.
Right.
But everybody made their escape that was involved in this operation.
In your pursuit of this case in you know, getting Pollard put away, was there any kind of interesting or very insightful experiences that occurred that you could call to memory?
Well,
that's a big question, isn't it?
That is a big question because this whole case was so crazy. I mean, you know, what was happening? It was almost like a fiction story. You know that you couldn't make this up. You know, this has got to be
right.
Fiction.
Yeah, it's like a novel, isn't it, huh?
It's exactly like a novel, and it's a devastating novel, and, you know, there were some funny parts in it and stuff, but not, Not many. I mean, it was pretty hardcore, particularly towards the end there, you know. And because Pollard had tried to befriend me that one time, do some business, you know, with somebody, that I used that against him when I interviewed him. And it worked. He lied to me at first and told me that, you know, I was asking him, did he make any money off of this? And he said, no. I was providing it to a newspaper reporter, he said. I said, so, well, how much did he pay you? And he said, he didn't pay me anything. I said, how many documents did you steal? And he was coming off with some light number, you know. And I said, so you're telling me that you're providing this reporter and he's not giving you any money? I said, you're a liar. That doesn't happen. And the interview lasted about 3 hours, and finally he admitted to me everything except who he was spying for. He kept going back to this reporter. But eventually we found out the truth. And he, you know, he confessed to it. And that's why they pled guilty in court. You know, there was a trial for Pollard or his wife. They both pled guilty.
Right. But I guess that would help not reveal some of the, damage that he did.
Oh, yes. Absolutely it did. Absolutely. Because if it would have went to trial, that would have been a real mess. That would have been a real mess because of the highly classified documents involved. It would have went on no telling how long, probably for years. So it was a good thing. They plead guilty and good for them.
Right. Wolf Blitzer interviewed, I guess when he was with Jerusalem Post, he conducted a jail cell interview with Pollard and penned an article. I think it ran in the Washington Post also, and entitled "Pollard, Not a Bummer, but Israeli's Master Spy." Now, I think it was published February 15th,
1987. That's correct.
He said Pollard told Blitzer about.
Well, Blitzer wrote a book on Pollard too. I don't know if you're aware.
Okay. No, I'm not. I'm not aware of that. But he said in there that he provided the Israelis reconnaissance satellite photography of the Palestinian Liberation Organization headquarters in Tunisia.
Yeah, I love.
Used for Operation Wooden Leg or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
I guess didn't they go in there and actually try to take out the head of the PLO?
Oh yeah,
one time in. You remember that there was a raid over there?
Yeah, there was a raid.
That's what this was.
What the whole thing was about. Yeah, there was a raid there. There was a raid.
And I think he survived, the PLO leader, Arafat, survived it, I believe.
Yeah, he did. He did.
I think he returned to the West Bank or something like that later. Something like that.
Yes, yes.
We have about 9 minutes left. We have about 9 minutes left. Are there some concluding details or concluding remarks, or would you like to speak to certain topics that we haven't covered yet?
Well, you know, I guess the thing that you know, Pollard getting out on parole. And as we said, I think he has to be on parole for 5 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
But in my opinion, because the public really doesn't know the damage that he did to our country at the time, they just don't know. And a lot of them know about it but don't care about it. Or say, no, that's not true. That's all lies about Pollard. And is not. Everything that I told you about Pollard is the truth. And every single word is in my book. But Pollard will go free after 5 years, and he will leave for Israel. And in my opinion, you know, I believe that Jonathan Pollard, when he is on parole, or before he's on parole and leaves, I think that Jonathan Pollard, on parole for the rest of his life, never being allowed to leave the United States. Because once he leaves the States and his 5 years are up, and he's no longer on parole, he will go straight to Israel, and he will have a hero's welcome to knock your socks off. Jonathan Pollard belongs in the United States, and under parole supervision, so that if any time during his lifetime he does something ridiculous or stupid or something against our national security, whether it's by voice, mail, whatever, he needs to go back to jail and spend the rest of his life in jail. That's my feel. Why would you send him to Israel? Why would you let him go to Israel? Why would you get him off of parole in 5 years? Hey, if he's on parole in the United States, he can travel wherever he wants to in the United States. But to allow him to fly to Israel and be a hero? No. That's a bad deal. That's a bad deal, like the Iran bad deal. That's my
right. Is he not a citizen of Israel too?
I'm sorry, you're cutting out.
Okay, I think he's a citizen of Israel. Is that right?
Well, you know, they came to his Butner, North Carolina. In the jail there, and there was a representative from Israel that came there and gave him a plaque and a nice little paper there that announcing that he is hereby now recognized as a citizen of Israel. Now, how many times does that happen in jail when you're in jail for a crime, serious crime? Somebody from another country literally gets to go into that jail and make him an Israeli citizen while he's still incarcerated? Does that make sense? I don't get it.
Especially the people he was spying for did it. Boy, isn't that a slap in the face? Huh?
I never did get that at all. But, you know, what can I say?
Boy, I tell you what. Are there any other conclusions you'd like to make before we sign off tonight?
No, I just appreciate you having me on. It was very kind of you, and maybe your listeners, you know, will understand a little bit more about the devastation that they did, that he did to the national security of our country. And
well, Ron Olive, you're a fine person. You stand on truth, and you really, and in your writing of this book, you really tried to put something out that was objective and that would establish a really good view of what happened.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that deeply.
And I thank you for being with us this evening. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye. I want to thank him again, Ronald Oliver, for being with us this evening. Next up, to finish out this first hour, I'm going to be playing Marion Spike Bowman. He's a former counterintelligence executive director, naval counterintelligence executive director. And here's what he has to say about Jonathan Pollard. We're going to end the program with this. Thank you for being with us this evening.
A sentence in there that said that if the death penalty were available, I would have no hesitation in recommending it. I crossed that out, and the next version I sent in to him, he put the same thing back in. And finally, I said, Mr. Secretary, if we can't ask for the maximum punishment, which is life, we can't say that death is appropriate. He finally got the picture. But anyway, this affidavit was then given to Judge Aubrey Robinson, who is now deceased. I took it to him personally. I sat in an outer room while he read it and gave it back to me and said, thank you very much. That's all he said. And then we went to sentencing. And at sentencing, the prosecutors really didn't say anything. They got up and they said he's done harm. He should receive a substantial sentence. But that's about the character of all they said. Jonathan Pollard got up and talked about what he had done and how sorry he was. And, by the way, I really didn't do anything that caused any harm. And Judge Robinson said, come up here, young man. And he pulled out the affidavit, which he now had in his hand, and he pulled it open to a few pages, and he said, okay, now explain this one. And Jonathan Pollard couldn't answer what it was because it was a very big deal. In fact, it has been made public now, so I can tell you what Judge Robinson was pointing at. It was something that we call the Raisin Manual. And the Raisin Manual was at that time, a document that described all of the communications capabilities of the Middle East and how NSA could attack them. And Judge Robinson just said, explain this one, young man, and he was done. So at sentencing, Jonathan Pollard got life, which, as I said, meant about 30 years. He has been there for about 27 or 8 years at this point. He has been eligible for parole for some time. He will not ask for parole because he wants clemency, so that as soon as he steps out of prison, he can leave the United States and go to Israel. So that is my story of Jonathan Pollard. I am going to finish, it looks like, 13 seconds early. So I thank you for coming here today. It's been a pleasure.